Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Women's bodies must not be held captive to government policies or alarmist narratives concerning population growth, the UN Sexual and Reproductive Health Agency, UNFPA, said in a major new report on Wednesday. As the world reached the milestone of 8 billion people on Earth last year, according to UNFPA, concerns over the number were causing anxiety and driving more governments to try to influence fertility rates. Over and over, we see birth rates identified as a problem and a solution with little acknowledgement of the agency of the people doing the birthing, said UNFPA's executive director, Natalia Kanem. She insisted that as women are empowered to make choices about their bodies and lives, they and their families thrive, and their societies thrive as well. The report's findings demonstrate the lack of agency experienced by millions of women worldwide. Around 24% of women and girls are unable to say no to sex, while 11% are unable to make decisions over contraception. UNFPA stresses that the best way to manage population change is to advance gender equality around the world. As fighting rages on in Sudan, humanitarian agencies are monitoring the arrivals of new Sudanese refugees in neighboring Chad, a representative of the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, shared on Twitter. UNHCR's Laura LoCastro tweeted about a joint mission conducted with the UN World Food Programme, WFP, the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, and Chad's National Commission in Charge of Refugees to observe the influx of new Sudanese refugees in the east, assess urgent needs, and agree on a response plan. She said there were an estimated 10,000 to 20,000 new refugees in the first three sites visited. Any new arrivals will be entering a situation marked by soaring humanitarian needs and chronic underfunding. Just last week, before the military power struggle erupted in Sudan, WFP warned that hundreds of thousands of refugees and internally displaced people in Chad could face hunger because there was no funding for food assistance beyond this coming May. Staying on the topic of hunger, food insecurity and malnutrition in West and Central Africa are projected to reach a 10-year high by June due to the combined effects of conflict, climate shocks, the COVID-19 pandemic and high food prices, UN agencies warned on Tuesday. According to new data, for the first time in the Sahel, 45,000 people are at risk of experiencing catastrophic levels of hunger or one step away from famine. The majority are in Burkina Faso and Mali, where violent unrest in some areas has hampered the delivery of humanitarian aid. Over 16.5 million children under 5 in the region are set to face acute malnutrition this year, including nearly 5 million who are at risk of debilitating severe malnutrition. The UN Food Programme, together with the Food and Agriculture Organization, the UN Children's Fund, and the UN Humanitarian Affairs Office, have renewed their call for greater support to countries in the region. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
That's right. It is a beautiful day today after a long night here in northeast Kansas and northwest Missouri as the long string of thunderstorms and sometimes violent wind came through over the evening and throughout early this morning. Really, it's pretty nasty weather. But the sky is clearing now, and tomorrow we're looking for sunshine. And it did drop the degrees down. It was quite stuffy in front of the front, perhaps 80 degrees. Stuffy, very humid. Now it's a very pleasant 62 degrees Fahrenheit, and it's actually a beautiful spring day here in Radio Free Kansas land. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. Now, look, we have this morning's latest headlines from Democracy Now!, and in the second hour, we'll have a special, some old clips that I've accumulated over the years, all about the abortion issue and women's personal autonomy over their bodies. So I'll be back on in the second hour. Right now, we're going to do the headlines of Democracy Now! And then go to Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Thousands of people have fled Sudan's capital, Khartoum, amidst an increasingly dire humanitarian crisis as fighting between two rival military factions continues into a sixth day. Several attempts to impose a ceasefire have failed. The United Nations reports nearly 300 civilians have been killed, though the true toll is likely far higher. The UN also warns of worsening shortages of food, water, fuel, and medical supplies. And Doctors Without Borders reports up to 70% of the hospitals in Khartoum and neighboring states are not able to function. This is Esra Abushama, a doctor at Sudan's health ministry.
Well,
most of the big and specialized hospitals are out of service and not offering any services of examination or treatment services for the patients because they have been targeted with shelling, and some of them because of the shortage of doctors and also because of electricity and water outages.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is in emergency talks today with members of the African Union, the Arab League, and other regional leaders. The meeting comes as aid workers report tens of thousands of Sudanese refugees have fled across the border into Chad. In Yemen, at least 79 people were killed in a stampede and over 100 injured Wednesday evening at a Ramadan charity event in the capital, Sana'a. Witnesses told the Associated Press the crowd crush began after armed Houthis fired into the air to control the crowd, striking electrical equipment and causing it to explode. Two men who organized the event have been arrested, and an investigation is underway. The United Nations is warning nearly 50 million people in West and Central Africa are at risk of hunger as the region's food insecurity crisis has been compounded by war, COVID-19, rising prices, and the effects of the climate catastrophe. Over 16 million children under 5 are facing acute malnutrition this year. Some 45,000 people in the Sahel are facing catastrophic hunger as fighting in the region has cut off humanitarian and food supply routes. Conflict around Lake Chad and in the Central African Republic have also made access near impossible. The World Food Program is struggling to respond to the crisis as it also grapples with a $900 million deficit. This is the World Food Program's Alexandre Lacoussette.
So we only have around 6 or 7 million people that we can reach, and even these 6 or 7 million people will be on rations that will be reduced for the moment. We will not have enough money to give total food rations or the 2,000 calories someone needs each day to be able to survive.
Meanwhile, a record-shattering heat wave has hit multiple Asian countries, including India, Bangladesh, Laos, Thailand, and parts of China. In the Indian state of Maharashtra, at least 13 people who attended an outdoor event died from heat stroke on Sunday. Scientific models predict extreme heat waves in India could get so bad they would not be considered survivable by 2050, even by a healthy person resting in the shade. This comes, as the UN said this week, India is poised to overtake China as the world's most populous country by June. A sweeping new study finds air pollution affects every stage of human life, from fetal development to old age dementia. The Environmental Research Group at Imperial College London reviewed tens of thousands of studies looking at different impacts of air pollution, including delays in fetal growth, diminished lung volume in children, reduced cognitive ability of adolescents, and continuing adverse mental health effects throughout life. This comes as American Lung Association reports over one-third of U.S. residents regularly breathe unhealthy air, with communities of color disproportionately affected. The Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, finds black people living in the U.S. in counties with more black primary care physicians live longer, whether or not they're treated by those doctors. Research has shown that when black doctors treat black patients, health outcomes are more positive, including in preventive care. Less than 6% of U.S. doctors are black, around half the proportion of black people in the U.S. population. The Supreme Court has pushed back a decision on the fate of the abortion pill mifepristone till Friday, keeping the country's most popular abortion method available for at least another 2 days as the court reviews a ruling earlier this month which banned the drug. We'll have the latest on the state of abortion access in the United States after headlines. In Oklahoma, a county commissioner in McCurtain County resigned Wednesday, days after a local newspaper published secretly recorded audio revealing he spoke with local law enforcement officials about lynching black people and assassinating reporters. Mark Jennings' resignation came after Oklahoma's Republican Governor Kevin Stitt called on him and three other officials to resign. They are County Jail Administrator Larry Hendricks, Sheriff's Investigator Alicia Manning, and McCurtain County Sheriff Kevin Clardy. In this clip, secretly recorded last month after a McCurtain County Board of Commissioners meeting and published by the McCurtain Gazette News, Jennings discusses the county's history of racist beatings and hangings with Sheriff Clardy. Listen carefully.
I'm going to tell you something. If it was back in the day, would Alan Marshall take a damn black guy, whoop their in the cell, I'd run the
Well, it's not like
that no more. I know. Take them down here on Mud Creek and hang them up with the damn rope.
Yeah.
But you can't do
anything about it.
They got more rights than we got.
Another clip. Sheriff Clardy and Jennings are heard discussing hiring hitmen to kill two journalists, a publisher and his son, who'd reported on misconduct by county officials. Since the McCurtain Gazette News published those and other hateful comments, Sheriff Clardy has so far refused calls to step down. The sheriff instead accused the publisher of the McCurtain Gazette News, Bruce Willingham, of making the recording illegally and predicted he would face felony charges. Willingham and his son, whose potential murders were discussed in the tape, have turned the recordings over to the FBI and the Oklahoma Attorney General. In Georgia, an independent autopsy has revealed an activist who was fatally shot by Atlanta police in January was struck by at least 57 bullets. 26-year-old Manuel Esteban Terán, known as Tortuguita, was killed as police raided an encampment of forest protectors opposing the construction of Atlanta's $90 million police training center dubbed Cop City. No officers have been charged over the killing. Meanwhile, at least 42 activists arrested while protesting Cop City face state charges of domestic terrorism. In Kansas City, Missouri, the white homeowner accused of shooting a black teenager who rang his doorbell by mistake pleaded not guilty Wednesday to charges of first-degree assault and armed criminal action. Prosecutors say 84-year-old Andrew Lester exchanged no words with 16-year-old Ralph Yarl before opening fire on him through a glass door, striking him in the chest and head. Yarl had simply gone to the wrong house to pick up his younger twin brothers. On Wednesday, activist and family spokesperson Sean King published a photo showing Ralph Yarl out of the hospital and posing alongside attorney Lee Merritt. King wrote that Yarl is recovering from a traumatic brain injury and faces a long road to recovery, adding, had the bullet hit his head a fraction of an inch in any other direction, he would probably be dead right now, unquote. Here in New York, prosecutors in Saratoga County have charged a 65-year-old man with second-degree murder after he allegedly shot and killed 20-year-old Kaylin Gillis on Saturday. Kaylin and a friend were shot after their car mistakenly pulled into the wrong driveway. Meanwhile, in Elgin, Texas, two cheerleaders were shot by a man in the parking lot of a grocery store Tuesday after one of them mistakenly tried to get into the wrong car where the man was. Although she apologized, he opened fire on her and her friends. In Maine, four people were fatally shot in their home Tuesday, shortly before three others were wounded by gunfire on a busy interstate highway. Police arrested a 34-year-old who just completed a sentence for aggravated assault. They say he confessed to the shootings, which left his parents and two of their friends dead. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been 166 mass shootings in the United States so far this year. Tennessee lawmakers have approved a bill to shield gun and ammunition manufacturers and dealers from lawsuits. Republican Governor Bill Lee has promised to sign the legislation, which comes less than a month after 3 9-year-old students and 3 adults were killed by a shooter armed with an AR-15-style semi-automatic assault rifle at the Covenant School in Nashville. In response, Democratic State Representative Justin Jones of Nashville tweeted, "There's a soul sickness in our state when Tennessee Republican legislators are more concerned with protecting gun manufacturers from lawsuits than children from being killed by mass shootings. We said, protect children, not guns. They choose the guns. This is morally insane," Justin Jones said. Meanwhile, special election dates have been set to fill the seats of the Democratic State Representatives Justin Jones and Justin Pearson after Tennessee Republicans voted to expel them for leading peaceful protests against gun violence inside the Tennessee legislature. Both black lawmakers have been temporarily reinstated to their House seats and are expected to compete in primaries to be held on June 15th with an election set for August 3rd. Republicans in Montana's legislature are attempting to censure Democrat Zoe Zephyr, Montana's first and only openly transgender lawmaker. This comes after Zephyr delivered a searing condemnation Tuesday of a bill that would ban gender-affirming health care for youth, among other anti-trans measures.
If you are forcing a trans child to go through puberty when they are trans, that is tantamount to torture. And this body should be ashamed. If you vote yes on this bill and yes on these amendments, I hope the next time there's an invocation, when you bow your heads in prayer, you see the blood on your hands.
The bill is expected to be passed and signed by the Montana Republican governor. Florida has been teaching about gender identity and sexuality throughout K-12 in all public schools, extending the ban known as Don't Say Gay that previously went through third grade. Teachers who violate the ban could have their licenses suspended or revoked. Joe Saunders of Equality Florida said, quote, "This rule is by design a tool for curating fear, anxiety, and erasure of our LGBTQ community." And the Biden administration has charged 4 U.S. citizens from a Pan-Africanist group with conspiring with the Russian government to sow discord in U.S. elections. Omali Yeshitela, chair of the African People's Socialist Party, faces charges of conspiracy to defraud the United States along with Penny Hess, Jesse Neville, and Augustus Romaine Jr. 3 Russians were also named in an indictment unsealed by the Justice Department on Tuesday. This follows a violent FBI raid on the activist properties in Missouri and Florida last summer. Speaking to Democracy Now! In August of last year, Omali Yeshitela called the FBI's case against his organization ridiculous and asinine.
The work we've been doing for 50 years as a party and that I've been doing for nearly 60 years is about the liberation of black people. I want to be clear on that. And the government is clear on that. They use Russia. They use this nonsense, even at a time when we've seen white people scaling the walls of the Capitol, threatening to kill the vice president, the feet on the desk of Nancy Pelosi. And you talk about we have some role under the Russians of contaminating the pristine elections that happen in this country.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Around the world, April 24th marks the observance of the Armenian Genocide. On that day in 1915, the Interior Minister of the Ottoman Empire ordered the arrest and hangings of Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople. It was the beginning of a systematic and well-documented plan to eliminate the Armenians, who were Christian and who had been under Ottoman rule and treated as second-class citizens since the 15th century. The unspeakable and gruesome nature of the killings, beheadings of groups of babies, dismemberments, mass burnings, mass drownings, use of toxic gas, lethal injections of morphine,
or injections with the blood of typhoid fever patients render oral histories especially difficult for survivors of the victims. Why did this happen? Despite being deemed inferior to Turkish Muslims, the Armenian community had attained a prestigious position in the Ottoman Empire, and the central authorities there grew apprehensive of their power and their longing for a homeland. The concerted plan of deportation and extermination was effected in large part because World War I demanded the involvement and concern of potential allied countries. As the writer Grigoris Balakian wrote, the war provided the Turkish government, quote, their sole opportunity, one unprecedented, to exploit the chaos of war in order to carry out their extermination plan. As they escaped to several countries, including the United States, a number of Armenians came to New Britain, Connecticut in 1892 to work in the factories of what was then known as the hardware capital of the world. By 1940, nearly 3,000 Armenians lived there in a tight-knit community. As you will hear from the stories of first-generation Armenian survivors who continue to live in New Britain, a shared history, a shared identity emerges. Some learned about the massacres directly from their parents or family members, while others were not told at all. Often, surviving women were ashamed to talk about what they had experienced because so many of them had been raped or forced into harems. For others, conjuring visual images of the atrocities was too painful to bear. When parents did speak about the crimes they experienced or witnessed, they often spoke in Turkish or Assyrian instead of English or Armenian, so that their children couldn't understand. Most children of survivors say that the topic was a secret, even forbidden. Meeting together to share memories and conversation are Jenny Garabedian, Arthur Shaverdian, Ruth Swisher, Harry Mazadourian, and Roxy Maljanian.
"95 years has gone by, and they still have not acknowledged that this happened, and it was a genocide.
As a nation, how can they deny this? I mean, how can it be denied? It's a half of a population was removed.
I don't like Turks per se because of what they did to our people, but I do enjoy the culture.
Why would I grow up hating the Turks if she didn't tell us stories? Well, then we must have been told something that we hated the Turks.
Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey.
Yeah, I think they were threatened by the culture. And the genocide started 1915, April 24, in Istanbul, where they took all the intelligentsia of the country and took them outside of the city and hanged them.
The overlay was, of course, religious, with Muslims, and they're the first country to acknowledge Christianity as a national religion. So, you know, there's a lot of history here with all of that.
The other thing that the Turks used to say, where is your Jesus now? Where is he? Why isn't he saving you?
Well,
they would
funny.
Say this on the death marches.
My brother Ernest was killed in an automobile accident. And his uncle came over to my house and said, "Hey, Ostian, where is your God now?" And she cupped her ears and she said, "Chilasim, chilasim, I don't want to hear that. God gave him to me and God took him away." How much more Christian could you be?
As you will hear from the stories of first-generation Armenian survivors who continue to live in New Britain, Connecticut, a shared history, a shared identity emerges. Some learned about the massacres directly from their parents or family members, while others were not told at all. Often, surviving women were ashamed to talk about what they had experienced, because so many of them had been raped or forced into harems. For others, conjuring up visual images of the atrocities was too painful to bear. When parents did speak about the crimes they experienced or witnessed, they frequently spoke in Turkish or Assyrian instead of English or Armenian, so that their children couldn't understand. Most children of survivors say that the subject was a secret, even forbidden.
My mother did not keep secrets from us. She spoke about the Turks. She hated the Turks. She made us hate the Turks. I remember as a teenager, I wanted to send away for Turhan Bey's picture in Hollywood, and he was a very handsome Turkish actor. We weren't allowed anyway. But the ones who did keep it secret were the ones who were ashamed of what happened. And I know for a fact many of the older women, older than my mother, had gotten raped. Those are the ones, in my opinion, in this area, were the ones who kept it secret.
I grew up hearing, like the others, my mother didn't talk about it to me, ever. But I was a little girl, and my mother was quite a bit older than I was. She was older when I was born. And so her friends would come over, and they would sit and talk to each other. The next thing you know, they'd all start crying. And I would cry, too. And my mother would turn to me and say, "Why are you crying?" And I'd say, "Because you're crying," and not knowing why I was crying.
And just recently we found out that this one got raped, that one got raped, and this is why they couldn't talk about it. Now, I don't know about the men, why the men kept it secret, but as far as the women, yes, you're right, the men were too young, but many of the women did get raped, and those are the ones, in my opinion, that really kept it a secret. And my mother told me many stories, so she wasn't ashamed. She didn't have that feeling of being ashamed.
In our house, it was a secret. And then you hear someone would be talking about something, and then as you approach, they say Biji Oğlan, which means little boy. That's me. And everything would switch into Turkish. Some Armenians would come visit from Whitensville, and they'd sit in the living room. They're all talking Turkish. It was a forbidden thing to discuss.
I had heard these stories. As I listened, I really heard these stories. And then the old country. They always talked about the old country. And I had no idea where it was. When I was a little girl, I thought the old country was like Holland, Connecticut, and I just had no idea, but I always wanted to go there. And then I felt terrible because I never had a grandmother or a grandfather or an aunt, a real aunt or an uncle.
As children growing up, you know, friends would come to the house. Now, they would always speak Armenian, but whenever they had an off-color story to tell, and you could always tell it was an off-color story because the way they broke into laughter, it was always told in Turkish or Assyrian, and then they'd revert back to English. So the stories were really not designed for children to hear, it was for them. But you could always tell by their laughter that something was going on, you know, that they didn't want us to know about. And in point of fact, that's what they always did. If there was something going on at the dinner table and they didn't want us to know what was going on, they'd speak Assyrian or Turkish to one another. So that whole business of speaking Turkish and the residual effects of the genocide were interesting, kind of almost juxtaposed one against the other.
Genocide has both physical and non-physical aspects, destroying the national culture of the oppressed group and imposing that of the oppressor. That was the theory of legal scholar Raphael Lemkin, who coined the word genocide in 1943 with the Turkish extermination of the Armenians in mind. While genocide is defined as the organized destruction, in whole or in part, of a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group, Lemkin wrote that a group need not be only physically exterminated to suffer genocide. Erasing a people's cultural identity through destruction of their language, religion, social, and political institutions, that too is genocide. The Armenian genocide, the very first of the 20th century, may be viewed in four distinct segments. The first segment began with the deportation and killing of the 250 intellectuals. Before that, in 1895, Ottoman suspicion of the Armenian population had led to the massacre of 300,000 Armenians by a special order of the government. In 1909, 30,000 more were slaughtered. The second segment involved the conscription of approximately 60,000 Armenian men into the General Turkish Army. They were later disarmed and killed by their Turkish counterparts. The third segment comprised of massacres, deportations, and death marches of women, children, and the elderly into the Syrian deserts. Hundreds of thousands were killed by Turkish soldiers, gendarmes, and Kurdish mobs. Others perished from famine, epidemic diseases, and exposure to the elements. Thousands of women and children were raped. Tens of thousands were forcibly converted to Islam. The final segment of the genocide is still ongoing and consists of the denial by the Turkish and United States governments that a genocide even occurred. Despite the body of documentation that exists, Turkey has launched a well-orchestrated and financed campaign of denial through inaccurate scholarship, propaganda, and extensive lobbying. Turkey even has a law which forbids mention of the word genocide.
Article 301 in Turkey essentially makes genocide an illegal word to use, a term. It's a denial. If you don't have the word, it doesn't exist. Genocide didn't exist. And so what you're doing is, in essence, is saying, if we don't recognize the word, if we don't use the word, then all mention, all concept of a genocide disappears. So what can you call it? Massacres? The first Holocaust? I mean, there are a lot of ways you can define it. They've chosen because it's genocide, and it truly was genocide. The issues are deep-seated. The conflicts were deep-seated. It's not only religious. It was control. It was economic. It was financial. Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey. I did some research, historical research as well. A lot of what we have is factual information because I have the original documentation. Some of it is put together from hearsay and then trying to create a story. And in those pieces that we don't know that I've created, I hope 2 + 2 becomes 4 and not 5. But it's close. It's close to the story. And the story begins, my father was born in 1903. He always said he was born in 1905, but when we look through the original documentation, it turns out he was baptized in 1903, so therefore he couldn't have been born in 1905. Likely it had to do with presenting himself as a younger person to be able to latch on to another member of the family to come to the United States as part of the visa process.
As a second-generation Armenian, I too have pieced together the fragments of stories from my family. My grandfather was a medical student at a college in Harpert. He said he had to beg his older sister for the tuition, and when he walked down the street, people would point to him with awe as the person who was going to college. When the genocide started, he enlisted or was drafted into the army. He narrowly and with difficulty escaped and came to the United States. I don't know how, but he was proud of the fact that he didn't have to disguise himself as a woman, as other men did, in order to beg or borrow his way out of the country. Then, in 1918, when Armenia was granted independence, he went back. He said the persecutions not only still existed, but that they were worse than before, so the process of escaping was even more difficult the second time. Coming to this country with no language or professional skills, he got a job in the foundry. In a short time, a flying piece of hot metal burned out one eye. The genocide ruined his life in Armenia and also in the United States. He had sent to the orphanage in Greece for a wife. The Armenian Relief Society paid for sending my grandmother to the United States. But when she got to Ellis Island, they wouldn't let her off the ship because of a gray halo around the iris of one eye. Again, the Relief Society paid to send her to Cuba because entry from there was less stringent. They found her a family to stay with, 9 people in a one-room house with a dirt floor. They took her daily to a clinic for a nurse to put eye drops in her eye. After 6 months, the nurse told the doctor that there was no change, so she must not have had an active, dangerous condition. The doctor agreed. Now it was better for her to enter through Mexico. Her daughter, my aunt, helped tell this story and says how impressed she always was with the kindness of strangers throughout the process. Historic Armenia was located along the Mediterranean Sea, in what exists today as Turkey. It's also, according to the Book of Genesis, where Noah's Ark came to rest, the first nation to adopt Christianity in AD 301. Armenians lived for centuries in their own kingdoms until the Ottoman invasions in the 1200s, when they became second-class citizens. After World War I, the independent Republic of Armenia existed for just 2 years, from 1918 to 1920, in a fragment of what had once been their homeland. While Armenians had been attacked often prior to the massacre of 1895, the later 1915 genocide had the specific goal of eradicating all traces of the ancient nation. With the outbreak of World War I, the Young Turk government wanted to save what remained of the weakened Ottoman Empire. It adopted a policy of pan-Turkism, the establishment of a vast Turkish empire comprised of all Turkish-speaking peoples of the Caucasus and Central Asia extending to China. The goal included the Turkification of all ethnic minorities of the empire. The Armenian population became the main obstacle toward realization of this policy. Although the decision to deport all Armenians from eastern Turkey had been adopted in late 1911, the Young Turks intentionally used World War I as a pretext for its implementation. Of the 3 million Armenians living in Turkey at that time, more than 1.5 million endured unimaginable atrocities, were slaughtered, raped, or forced into Muslim harems. Churches, which formed the religious and cultural backbone of their lives, were destroyed, while homes were burned, property confiscated, and families killed and separated forever. Lucy and Roxy, Araxi, Maljanian, and Mary Abrahamian are sisters. Together they recount their mother's story.
My name is Roxy Yesyan Maljanian. My mother came from the village of Ichme in Harput, Armenia, Turkey now, and I'm one of three sisters that are here present representing our family. And the family name was Pilibozhin. Kuyumjan was a deep name. And our mother was born in 1908. And she came here to America after the genocide. And as a little girl, she remembers quite a few things about 1915. And when my mother was in her late 60s, early 70s, she started writing her history in Armenian. And she wrote it in very colloquial Armenian. She was an Armenian school teacher here in New Britain, taught students after she got married and came here. And in her story, since it was in Armenian, my sisters and I translated it after her death. She wrote it in the last years of her life. And she remembered many things of her childhood. And we divided the story into three sections. And each sister took a third of it to translate it the best we can. We all read Armenian. Like I said, she did it simply so we can understand it. We knew some of the stories. She talked about them, her childhood in the orphanage. And she tells us the nice things, really, about the orphanage. As children, she was 7 years old until she was 18. She was in the orphanage. She remembers the groups of children who were all just like her. They had lots of fun because they were children. And they played games and sports. And they learned crafts in the orphanage, the German Protestant orphanage. It taught them crafts, handiwork. So they learned many things, reading and writing. So they were happy as much as possible because everybody was in the same situation. And she remained there until 18. And at 18, there were newspapers here in America looking for orphans in different orphanages. And if your name appeared on a list, the orphan director would send a letter to the person in America, and that we have this child in this orphanage, and they would write to the orphan, and the orphan would identify herself or himself. And in that way, they were able to get to America through a relative that was here. That's one way that people got a home. But at 18, you had to leave the orphanage. When she was 7, 1908 to 1915, she was 7 years old. Before she got to the orphanage, she remembers as a little girl, the Turkish people in the villages were all their neighbors, and they got along very good with their neighbors, and they had fun with them because they were all in the same community. Even though the majority in this village was Armenian, they had Turkish people living there too. The trouble started, the rumors start coming into the villages that things were happening, and their children. She was warned that if something happened, you know, you go with your aunts and uncles. Her mother had died when she was a child, and she was living with aunts in the village. And her father was already in America, so they lived with the aunts. The first one of the incidents she writes and talked about was she remembered the gathering of the men in the village. And the village of Ichimet, the houses were low roof, and you can go on your roof and look at what's happening. And the church was right below the street that they lived on. And my sisters and I both, all three of us, have visited Ichimet, and we took two trips to Ichimet so we can kind of visualize what happened. The church was on the street below, and they remember the men being gathered and taken into that church and hollering, and they heard the screams, and the next thing, the church was being burned, and they remember the church being burned and screaming and the hollering of all the people dying in this building. And then she recalled going from house to house. They were starting to hide from things, and you can run on the rooftops in Ichimet. They were flat roofs close to each other. And you could jump, and you're 7, 8 years old. You jump from building to building. And they were able to jump to the next building and hide in the neighbor's house. So now they knew there was trouble. So you could go down to the next house, and hide somehow. She remembered that. And then when the time came, and they were coming into the village, and they'd see more. Maybe my sister Lucy can relate that part of the village. Do you remember them, the hiding, what the uncle told them to do?
When they came into the homes, they all had to gather whatever belongings they had to start the march. They told my mother, we're going to hide our gold. It's going to be in this chest and come in the back, and we're going to hide it in the ground. But you never, ever tell anybody where it is. So all their gold coins and jewelry, they hid in the backyard, courtyard, wherever it was. And then they gathered them up, and they started this horrific march.
The Armenian identity is now a collective one, pieced together from historical documents and personal stories handed down from survivors to their children. The media did cover the events as they happened, and the U.S. ambassador to Turkey, Henry Morgenthau, told the Secretary of State in July 1915 that, quote, a campaign of race extermination is in progress, under a pretext of reprisal against rebellion. On May 6, 1915, the New York Times reported that, quote, the Young Turks have adopted the policy of Sultan Abdulhamid, namely, the annihilation of the Armenians. Recording oral histories, however, was much more difficult. For the most part, it was simply too painful for survivors to talk about what they had been through and witnessed. First-hand accounts do exist because some wrote letters or kept journals that have been translated into English. One comprehensive eyewitness account and political analysis Armenian Golgotha, by Grigoris Balakian, was recently translated by Peter Balakian with Aris Savag. Other survivors shared narratives with their siblings, who later told their children what happened. It is not surprising that the legacy of pain still endures 100 years later, as first-generation survivors frequently are moved to tears when they recount the details that have been passed down. In struggling to survive amidst innumerable challenges, many Armenians relied on the kindness of strangers. Getting married provided one way for women to escape safely, with Turks offering to save women if they would marry their sons or other male relatives. Some Turkish families harbored Armenians in order to save them, and refugees' resourcefulness knew no limit, with many heading to neighboring Arab countries, where they used discarded metal and wood to fashion makeshift shelters.
My mother survived two genocides. There was a genocide in 1895. My mother was born in 1886, and she was a 9-year-old girl. And she used to tell the story of her mother taking her to the well and trying to drown her.
Jenny Garabedian's Armenian mother was an orphan and is among many who made their way to the United States.
At that time, because it was just so terrible, at that time the village priest came along and tried to stop them, and they did obviously stop them. But then my grandparents were taken in the second wave in 1915, aunts, uncles, everything. My mother told me quite a few stories. My uncle, her brother, was married to a woman. The way the genocide started in certain regions of Turkey, and then they moved them south, and then they came to the village of Harpert, and that was one of the stopping places of these marches. She went out to the village, to the barn one night, and there was this woman with no clothes, with a little baby in her arms. And the woman said to her, "Try to help me, whatever you can do, you know, I would appreciate." And my mother said her brother's wife had died. And so she said, "You wait here." She said the next day she went, she bathed that woman, cleaned her up, and took her to her brother and said, "Here, marry this lady." And he did. But he was a lot older. I remember even as a child, it was saving a life. Getting married was saving a life. This is the thing that they talked about. And she told another story of a band of gypsies. She was there through the whole genocide. It started in 1915, and she left there in 1922, left Turkey in 1922, with two small children. My father was in the United States, and my brother was born in 1907, my sister in 1909, so she had these little kids. And hiding from village to village, my brother used to tell the story, and every time he told it, he'd cry, that they were in the fields one day, and my mother went to him and said, "Here, take care of your sister. I'm a grown woman. They're going to come for me. I know that." And so she just left my brother and sister together, these little kids, and went and hid someplace. And for a couple of months, I mean, this was a long period of time, and then eventually came back and got her kids. I wondered, how did they survive? What did they do in the interim? What were they eating, and what were they doing, and where were they staying? You know, these are things we don't know, the logistics of exactly what happened. But anyway, this other story of the gypsies. She went out one night, and this whole band of gypsies was there, and this lady said to her, whispered to her, "I'm an Armenian, but I just joined these gypsies to save my life." And she said to her, "Well, you wait here, and I'll try to get you out." And again, she hid the lady. And the next day, she did somehow give the lady some money or clothes or something, and she got her away from the gypsies. Years later, my mother was in a refugee camp in Aleppo, Syria, because that's what they did. She was not in the death march. Somehow she escaped that death march. I don't know how. I think from hiding.
If you're just joining us, we devote our entire show to commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide.
Another thing, when they were to leave the country in 1922, things supposedly had calmed down, but the Turkish government required them to have, I guess today we'd call this an exit visa. They had to have a stamp in their passport or their papers. And every day she'd go to the town hall and ask them to stamp her papers, and they wouldn't stamp them. Finally, she got fed up with that. She found the man that made the stamp. She had a stamp made, stamped her papers, and left with her two children. Again, it was treacherous because they were walking and they were coming down. They, too, were in that city of Harput. They were in one of the outlying villages. But there were Kurds in those mountains. There were Turks. They came down through Diyarbakir and Urfa and places like that. She ended up in this refugee camp. My father in the States had no idea whether she was alive or dead or what had happened to her. So at that time, he was working in Landers Ferry and Clark. And I have a letter that his foreman wrote and said, you know, this man doesn't know whether his family's living. He's going back to look for them. And so he went back and he found them in this refugee camp and got them, well, he got my mother and my sister here. By then, she also had saved a couple of nephews, and that's all she had. And therefore, I have cousins living in France. All of us have relatives all over the world, and for this reason. When I went back to her village in Turkey, a lady, because I went back there several times, a lady came out of her house and said, I saved your mother during the genocide. And I came, she was alive, my mother, at that time, and I came and asked her, and she said, yes, she hit us one night. Now, that was at peril to their own lives, because anybody caught hiding an Armenian would also be killed.
Arthur Tverdian describes his father's visceral reaction to Turkish music in just one example of how random daily occurrences could, with little warning, trigger memories of the atrocities survivors had experienced.
The other thing that my father was very strong about was listening to Turkish music. And I can remember going to weddings, and if the band started playing Turkish music, he would get up and say, we're leaving and going home. And we did. I can remember one time I was with, she wasn't my wife at the time, and we were at a close family friend's wedding. My parents had come with us. We had driven. And I can recall vividly my father saying, I can't stay. Why are they playing Turkish music instead of playing Armenian music at an Armenian wedding? And we got up and left. It was as simple as that. He couldn't handle it. So it came out in different ways, that experience. I mean, and you know, as a child, even as a young adult, quite frankly, it didn't mean anything to us. You know, what was past. We were living in the present, looking at the future. They were thinking in terms of the past and what they had experienced. As you get older, you come to better understand the past and what the past has done to create the present that you're in and how it shapes your future. And so when you look at that, I mean, I can remember my poor father. I really, what I did to him sometimes was just unconscionable. I can remember conversations, and I remember this one vividly when we were talking about things like, you know, Turkey. And I was saying, but the Turks are the friends of the Americans. I mean, they're bottling up, you know, the Black Sea so that the Russians can't get out with the Russian submarines. He would just explode when I would say things like that. That was just unconscionable as far as he was concerned. And so that conversation, I can remember with him, I could never quite figure out where he was coming from. Now, keep in mind, I was 16, 17, 15 years old. You know, I was into study of history, United States, and passionate about America. Didn't have a real understanding. And a lot of that, I would suggest, is really maturity, to be able to understand how people felt at these occurrences, what took place back there. And I think, you know, I marvel at the kids that I sometimes teach, that their ability to appreciate what happened and put that in the bigger context of the Holocaust and genocide in other parts of the world, to me is pretty remarkable at their maturity that I didn't have at that age. But the kids really do feel it differently. That is kind of the nutshell of the story of my father. We know that as a young adult, he had his name put on his first cousin's family list for a visa to come to the United States. He was originally done in Tabriz, and what's interesting is that when you look at the paperwork, and I've got the paperwork so I could read it, and the paperwork made it very clear that he was listed in Tabriz. He was at that point living in Kermanshah, asked to be put on the visa list there, which they would do, but it all had to be worked out. The interesting piece was because of the limitations of immigration into the United States at that time, if he did not go, if his name was called and didn't show up when his name was called, the list apparently, and it's quoted, is approximately 14 years before your name would be called again. So you had to be sure that you were on target and knew what was going on. And my father communicated. I have copies of the letters that he wrote. It was common back then that you would handwrite a copy of a letter, correct it, write it, and then either have it typed or write it out yourself so that it would be accurate. I remember my father doing that in correspondence with other people. He would write it out and then rewrite it and send it off. So he always had the original copy to make sure that in English he said what he meant to say. At that point, he came to the United States. He was sponsored by his father's sister. So he had an aunt living in New Britain, and she sponsored him, which meant that he didn't have to go through Ellis Island. So his name doesn't appear in Ellis Island as one of the immigrants going through Ellis Island. He went directly into New York and went with some family. We're not sure who lived at that particular address, but we know that it was family, friends. He lived with them for a short time and then went to New Britain, Connecticut to work. He had written to a factory in New Britain, the Corbin Screw Company, which no longer exists. They wrote back saying that they would offer him a position if he came to work as a machinist, keeping in mind that, you know, he had a very limited formal education, although he self-taught some Russian, some French, Turkish, Syrian, as well as Armenian, some Farsi he could read. So he learned quite a bit, self-taught how to play an instrument, the mandolin, self-taught how to play rudimentary piano. So the guy was... Yeah, I'm bragging. The guy was bright, obviously. He came to the United States. The only work he could get was as a machinist, unskilled laborer. He had worked for a period of time for an oil company in Iran, and he was a bookkeeper there, but probably didn't have formal skills and training in that. So that's the story of his coming to the United States.
Numerous historians and academics worldwide have recognized the genocide, including the International Association of Genocide Scholars. Documentation exists in official state records of the United States, Great Britain, France, Germany, Austria, and Hungary. The Turkish government consistently rejects charges of genocide, usually claiming that the Armenians who died there were caught up in a civil war, or that the Armenians supported enemies of the Ottoman Empire and deserved to die. A smaller group of historians, funded by the Turkish government, actively denies that what happened was a genocide. Turkish Law 301 is an article of the Turkish Penal Code that makes it a crime to insult Turkey, the Turkish ethnicity, or Turkish government institutions. It went into effect on June 1, 2005, as part of a package of law reforms preceding negotiations for Turkish membership in the European Union, in order to bring Turkey up to, quote, union standards. The earlier version of the law made it a crime to, quote, insult Turkishness. In 2008, the wording was changed from Turkishness to the Turkish nation. Turkish historian Taner Aksam left the country fearing for his life after claiming there had been a genocide. In 2006, Armenian-Turkish journalist Hrant Dink was prosecuted under Article 301 and received a six-month suspended sentence. In 2007, he was assassinated by radical nationalists. One of the primary ways of erasing the Armenian culture was by the so-called Turkification of orphans. Hundreds of thousands of young children were placed in Ottoman orphanages and converted to Islam, forbidden to speak Armenian, and given Turkish names that often match the first initials of their Armenian surname and given names. By order of the Minister of the Interior, The only children permitted to stay in the orphanages were those who didn't remember what had happened to their parents. Many Armenian children were brought up in Turkish families, a subject that remains sensitive to this day. Muslim Turks who acknowledged their Armenianism were labeled by the Turks as outcasts, gabur, those without belief, without a soul. Those who were not brought up in Turkish families were killed. According to the order of Talat, the Minister of the Interior of the Ottoman Empire was instructed to remove all non-Turkish Armenians from age 5 and up, and to take them out of the town to be slaughtered. They were subjected to the worst crimes of humanity. Some were burned alive, others poisoned or drowned, starved to death, or left to perish from disease. Mass burnings of children took place in large part in the Bitlis province. A Swedish missionary named Alma Johansson ran the German orphanage in Mush and reported that many Armenian women and children were burned alive as orphans. Mass burnings also took place in Deir Zor, where the orphans were first taken to a large building, then pushed in batches to a spot an hour from the city, where they were doused with petrol and torched to death. Such practices also existed in the provinces of Harpert and Diyarbakir. Turkish physicians engaged in the poisoning of children. Survivors have testified how in one province the local pharmacist and doctor organized the poisoning of approximately 500 orphans. Based on evidence from local Turkish doctors, officials have testified that babies brought to the city's Red Crescent Hospital were also systematically poisoned. Those who refused to take the so-called medicine were drowned at the nearby Black Sea. There were other mass drownings. Large numbers of Armenian children were disposed of at the Mesopotamian lower ends of the Euphrates River in Deir Zor. There, the chief of police, on October 24, 1916, ordered approximately 2,000 orphans carried with their hands and feet bound to the banks of the Euphrates. Reports are that two by two, the children were tossed into the river to the perceptible enjoyment of the police chief. Mass drownings of children occurred in other regions, including Kamakh Gorge on the Euphrates River. At that time, U.S. Ambassador Henry Morgenthau said that at Kamakh Gorge, hundreds of children were bayoneted by the Turks and thrown into the Euphrates. Ruth Swisher's mother was orphaned along with her two sisters and was shifted from place to place before finally arriving in the United States.
My mother, as a child of 12, was put in the orphanage because she was quite beautiful and the Turk wanted to marry her. And like I said, this is all hearsay. My mother actually did not tell me this. A lot of other people in New Britain have told me these stories. She was in Yereki in an orphanage. And from Yereki, they went to the city of Harpet. They were there for a while. Then they were going to go to Lebanon. They were going to transport the children to Lebanon. The Lebanese did not want them. They ended up on a boat going to Istanbul, and the boat had a leakage in it, and they thought the children had drowned. But actually, they survived. They had a mass after 40 days in Istanbul, you know, just a remembrance, a 40-day remembrance. And then when they arrived in Istanbul, they had a massive celebration for all the orphans. But unfortunately, the Turks started stoning these orphans. So they were unable to stay in Istanbul, and they were looking for passage or for some country to take them, and no one wanted the orphans. Finally, Venizelos in Greece said, bring the orphans to me. I will house them. I don't know how many orphans there were. I have no clue. But they were a mixed bag. They considered each other's brothers and sisters. As a matter of fact, to the end of my mother passed away, she was still looking for people, and they were finding each other. Every now and again, one would come across. Well, anyways, they ended up staying on Constitution Plaza in the old palace in Greece. Venezuelans put them up there. There must have been about 300 orphans. I'm not quite sure of the number. And then they went to Piraeus, and they stayed there for 3.5 years after something was built for them, some facilities. And from there, my mother went to Beirut. She lived there for 12 years and then came to America and married my father. That was a fix-up. My name is Ruth Hovsepian Swisher. My mother's name was Siranush Simonian, but she went into the orphanage as Siranush Barbarian because the Turks were looking for her. and she went under an alias. She just kept going back to Yeriki, where she was born, and talking about this neighbor and that neighbor and this mulberry tree or this apricot tree or some such thing, but never of the atrocities that happened to them. Absolutely nothing. She would tell my daughters more than she would tell me, and then they always spoke of it in the house. Other villagers would come over, and they would talk about the different things and the orphanages, etc., and that's how I pieced things together. And what I have is actually factual, because my mother did tell me that they were stoned, and the boat was sinking, and there were other people in New Britain, a Yelsal Macedonian that was on the same boat, and, you know. All I know is when I was growing up, I was a very slow eater. My mother said I would never survive in the orphanage.
As you will hear, when asked if they can forgive the Turks for the crimes of 1915 and the continued refusal to acknowledge the genocide, first-generation survivors' feelings are as varied as their individual experiences. For many, it is difficult to forgive as long as the descendants of the Ottoman Turks continue to deny that their predecessors engaged in genocide.
And of course, my father was a gamarbor, and a gamarbor means a volunteer. He joined the French army, and they signed papers that they were only going to fight for the sake of the Armenians. And he went from village to village to village, to all the orphanages, looking for people. He didn't find a soul. His family was all gone, just completely wiped out. Oh, yes, he went to one orphanage, and on the door was their orphans' names. And he found a first cousin, and she ended up coming to New Britain to live. My father's family is very sparse, whereas my mother had more. I think more survived in her family than my dad's. There were only five living relatives on my dad's side. And they weren't even brothers or sisters. They were just first cousins, actually. From large families, dwindled down to nothing.
During the genocide, the Allied powers, Great Britain, France, and Russia, responded to news reports by issuing a warning to Turkey, quote, "The Allied governments announce publicly that they will hold all members of the Ottoman government, as well as such of their agents are as implicated, personally responsible for such matters." Such warning had no effect, however. After World War I, the young Turks in power resigned their government posts and fled to Germany, where they had been offered asylum. Turkey's new moderate government and the Allies asked repeatedly that Germany return the young Turks to stand trial at home. These requests were denied. Armenian activists located the young Turks and assassinated them, along with two other instigators of the mass murders. A new Republic of Armenia was formed. Representatives attended the Paris Peace Conference with hope that the victorious allies would return their historic lands seized by Turkey. In response, the European allies asked the United States to assume guardianship of the new republic, something that President Woodrow Wilson wanted, but that Congress rejected. Thanks to Wilson's persistence, the Treaty of Sèvres was signed on August 10, 1920, recognizing an independent Armenian state in an area comprising much of the former historic homeland. But Turkish nationalism persisted. The moderate Turkish leaders who had signed the treaty were ousted in favor of a new national leader, Mustafa Kemal, who disavowed the treaty and reoccupied the lands in question. Surviving Armenians were expelled, including thousands of orphans. No Allied power would come to the aid of the Armenian Republic, and it collapsed. Just a small portion of the easternmost area of historic Armenia survived as part of the Soviet Union. Some ask what the importance is of formally recognizing the Armenian genocide. One need only look at history for an answer. A young Adolf Hitler remarked on the tepid reaction of the world's power elites to the plight of the Armenians. After he achieved power in Germany, in 1939, Hitler decided to conquer Poland, telling his generals, quote, "Thus for the time being I have sent to the east only my death's head units, with the orders to kill without pity or mercy all men, women, and children of Polish race or language. Only in such a way will we win the vital space that we need. Who still talks nowadays about the Armenians? In 2008, a group of Turkish intellectuals offered their apologies to the Armenian people in an online petition, available in 8 languages. The petition read, quote, "My conscience does not accept the insensitivity showed to and the denial of the great catastrophe that the Ottoman Armenians were subjected to in 1915. I reject this injustice, and for my share, I empathize with the feelings and pain of my Armenian brothers and sisters. I apologize to them." In the first 2 hours after launching the petition, over 5,000 people signed, including over 200 Turkish journalists, historians, scholars, musicians, and political scientists. Turkish media reported a sharp criticism of the initiative by the country's nationalist circles. A group of nearly 60 former ambassadors reportedly issued a joint statement warning that the started campaign was, quote, "fraught with negative consequences for national interests." While citizens of Turkey and Turks living in different countries around the world signed the petition, they nonetheless avoided using the word genocide, instead calling the events the Great Catastrophe.
This was done by design, by government design. That's what they're trying to deny, that it wasn't a design, but it was, because it was done so systematically. First the intelligentsia, then the villages and all the men, then leaving
men.
Women and children. This and it was step by step by step.
They took doctors or the men, like you say, the intelligentsia, and that was the end. My mother-in-law told me that story. I remember very well. Then she had a brother, Zadeh, whom my husband was named after because he was a boy. They took him and they kidnapped him, and they don't... What happened to him?
A Turk wanted to marry my mother at the age of 12. And as a matter of fact, he came to this country. He went to Beirut to find my mother's relatives after the massacres looking for my mother. And they hid my mother in Beirut. And then he came to America and he sent his brother to America looking for my mother when he found out my mother had come to America. That's the truth. He went all the way to Worcester, and they wouldn't, he found someone in Worcester from the same village. Yeah.
And when I had my first child, she was 1 year old, we were in Florida on a vacation, and she got feverish, and there was a doctor there, they said, on the premises, and he's Turkish, he'll treat your daughter. I was frightened to take medicine from this medical man. You know, this is 1958, 59, and I was still afraid of what a Turk might do. But just to bring us up to 2010, my husband right now, at present, this is Roxy speaking again, has almost like a best friend, Turkish grocer in our neighborhood, who we speak very openly of the genocide to him. He never learned any of these things himself. And he marches in Washington with the Turks, which I'm still against that. But he loves us Armenians, he says.
I just want to mention that the women have a different exchange than the males in the family. As young males, we were heavily protected from this this event.
On April 12, 2015, Pope Francis, the leader of 1 billion Roman Catholics around the globe, referred to the slaughter of the Armenians as the first genocide of the 20th century. His words angered Turkish diplomats, who condemned them and recalled their ambassador to the Holy See. Previously, officials at the Vatican have avoided using the term genocide. But the Pope said, quote, "It seems that the human family has refused to learn from its mistakes caused by the law of terror, so that today, too, there are those who attempt to eliminate others with the help of a few, and with the complicit silence of others who simply stand by.
Coming up tomorrow on Radio Free Kansas.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
James Madison, the father of the United States Constitution worried about the dangers of religious factions. And what would happen if the strains of religious extremism were allowed to take hold in the American government? For too long, religious extremists in Kansas government have dominated the political landscape and made a mockery of our free, secular republic. These politicians want to turn the statehouse into a cathedral for their brand of faith. They believe their God, their religious traditions, their beliefs should dictate public policy for all Kansans. In their arrogance, they have concocted laws based upon misogynist doctrines without any concerns for the rights and freedoms of Kansas women. Today, no government business can be conducted in Kansas without first bowing to the religious extremists. At all levels of government, their narrow view infects public policy. At the state level, an attempt was made to give taxpayer money through backdoor school vouchers to religious schools and thereby weaken public schools. Passage of the Kansas Preservation of Religious Freedom Act would allow individuals to discriminate against gays and lesbians based upon the employer's religious beliefs. And the ridiculous bill that would define life as beginning at fertilization is clearly the most shocking assault on women's civil liberties and autonomy as full persons. Yes, the war on women will not succeed without setting up a theocratic state. To accomplish this, elected officials in Kansas refuse to respect the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution, which prohibits the government from favoring one religion or faith to rule government. Kansas officials also disregard with impunity Article 7 under the Kansas Bill of Rights. It reads in part that in Kansas, no preference may be given under law to any religious establishment or mode of worship. Defining life as beginning at fertilization certainly establishes under the law one religious doctrine of faith for all to obey. Kansas women have no intention of allowing religious doctrines to corrupt our laws. We most certainly reject any Christian doctrine supported by legislative statutes to degrade women's civil liberties and freedoms. To be clear, women are not chattel, they are not baby machines, they are not sex slaves to their male masters. Women are human beings who have every right to do what is right for their health and mental freedom. All Kansans must stand up against the horrific political malpractice taking place in Kansas against women. We must not be bullied by politicians who despise any woman for refusing to bow in submissiveness to the state that seeks to control her womb. Upholding the separation of church and state is the only way we can stop the theocratic madness in Kansas. Today, we stand together to loudly proclaim we will not be defeated by the religious extremists in Kansas government. The forces behind the suppression of women and their rights are powerful, but we must be more powerful, more dedicated to preserving the separation of church and state if we are to live free and determine our own destiny as citizens of this democratic republic. Victory is our only option.
Delivered on the State House steps in Topeka, Kansas by Vicki Stengel. Years and years ago, in the aftermath of Dr. George Tiller being gunned down, his brains being blown out, by a fanatic, a religious fanatic, in Dr. Tiller's church. That was long ago. We have so much to go now to protect the autonomy of people's bodies, and most especially women.
Okay, I want to thank those that have been working in coalition to make this day happen. I know we had people from MoveOn.org working. We had ACLU and Planned Parenthood who lobbied day in and day out during the legislative session that also contributed to this effort. I am Carrie Ann Rinker, and I'm state coordinator of the Kansas National Organization for Women. Unite Women, we are marching against the war on women. And we stand here in solidarity with people from all over the nation marching today on their state capitol. So we may be 350 here, but across the nation, we are far, far exceed that. I'm going to ask, if you're speaking today, so I've got Representative Ann Ma, Representative Finney, Lane Campbell, Marguerite Reed, Charlie Jenny, Stephanie Mott, Michelle Stubblefield, Heidi Chulissa, Callie Benton, Vicki Stangle, and Tamara and Crystal from Kansas United, who also did a lot to make today happen. If you're on that list of speakers, could you come up here, please?
Critical speech delivered by Carrie Ann Rinker on the State House steps with Vicki Stangle. However, I must tell you, the Kansas phenomena, the social phenomena that happened in 2022 when the Kansas Republican Party held their primary to change the Kansas Constitution failed by the outgrowth of an enormous and a landslide. Failed to stop the power of women who organized. Carrie Ann Rinker and Vicki Stangle both were pioneers in that fight years and years ago. They were reluctant to bring the voice of Dr. Chris, known legally as Dr. Ann Kristen Newhouse, that day on the State House. The last licensed Kansas physician to work with Dr. George Tiller.
And I just can't tell you all how happy I am to see everyone here today and to hear all the wonderful things that we've heard so far. The dialogue here in Kansas has become so much more critical and elevated in the last year or so, and I can't tell you how happy and heartwarming that is. The one good thing for, I think a lot of you probably know my story. I'm in the paper a lot as, whatever, incompetent, physician for protecting the rights of women and protecting their medical records. But the one thing I can say that I'm happy about losing my license is that I will now not be forced to lie to my patients. When I first read that legislation, I realized that it was obviously giving physicians a license to not tell patients the truth. But then further on in the wording of it, it's apparent that they also will require us to tell patients something which has unequivocally not been proven. It's absolutely untrue that there's any scientific link whatsoever of breast cancer with having had an abortion. Yeah. Absolute false. You could make a little plot and show that piracy was more related to breast cancer than having an abortion. I don't need to go on about it. There's no scientific or medical organization that has endorsed that. It's totally BS. Watch my language. Once again, I want to thank you all. I think Time Magazine has announced the last 2 years that the person of the year has been the citizen activist. And that is really all of you and all of us. And thank you so much.
Dr. Chris lost her license, condemned in internal exile here in Kansas. Here is Democracy Now, this morning, today, talking about the outcome nationwide.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court pushed back their decision on the abortion pill mifepristone until Friday, keeping the country's most popular abortion method available for at least another day, as the court reviews a ruling earlier this month which banned the drug. The Center for Reproductive Rights said the court, quote, should have issued a stay, but instead the court continues to delay any action. In the meantime, abortion providers and their patients across the country have been living in chaos, unclear if they'll still be able to prescribe and access this critical medication, unquote. The Justice Department and drug maker Danko Laboratories warned the court if it does not step in, the supply of the medication could end almost immediately. They say one version of the medication would be considered misbranded and the generic version would be rendered unapproved. This week, the maker of the generic version of mifepristone sued the FDA in a bid to keep the drug on the market no matter what the court rules. The original April 7th ruling in the fast-moving case was by the Trump-appointed U.S. District Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, a longtime abortion opponent and activist. The Supreme Court's orders on Wednesday were issued by Justice Samuel Alito, who also wrote the decision in the Dobbs ruling last year that ended the constitutional right to abortion, overturned Roe v. Wade. For more on all of this and the fight to keep abortion legal and accessible, we're joined by two guests. In Wichita, Kansas, Julie Burkhardt is with us. She's president of Wellspring Health Access and co-owner of Hope Clinic. She worked for 8 years with the abortion provider, Dr. George Tiller, before he was assassinated in church in 2009. Last May, her clinic, which was set to open in just weeks, was firebombed by an anti-abortion arsonist. Her recent piece for Salon is headlined, "I Own the Only Abortion Clinic in Wyoming. Post-Roe America is a Tragedy and an Opportunity." We're also joined by Michelle Goodwin, visiting professor of law at Harvard Law School and founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. She hosts the Ms. Magazine podcast on the issues with Michelle Goodwin and is the author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Last year, she wrote a guest essay for the New York Times headlined, "I Was Raped by My Father and Abortion Saved My Life." We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Michelle Goodwin, let's begin with you. Start off with what this temporary stay, well, the first one was temporary until this past Wednesday, and now until Friday. What does this stay mean?
Well, this stay could mean that the court is still deliberating. It could mean that there are justices that are drafting dissenting opinions, concurring opinions. We don't know, but it means something more, which is that mifepristone is still available. It is still available under the conditions that were set by the FDA prior to Judge Matthew Kaczmarek's opinion. That is the judge in Amarillo, Texas, that decided that mifepristone should be removed from the marketplace, basically siding with the petitioners who claimed that the drug was rushed to the market and that it was unsafe. It's worth noting, Amy, as you've discussed before, that this is a drug that was under review for 54 months when it was put on the marketplace in 2000. To put that in comparison with other FDA-approved drugs in that same period, they were reviewed for about 15 months. And then secondly, the claims that it is an unsafe drug really is quite unfounded. When the FDA did approve mifepristone to be in the marketplace, it had already been used in Europe for decades, and we know through decades of research since 2000, when it was placed in the marketplace, that it is a drug that has lower morbidities than Tylenol, than Viagra, than penicillin. So we don't know what the Supreme Court will do on Friday, but one more point with this is that there are over 200 drug manufacturers that have signed a letter expressing their deep concern about the ruling that came out of Amarillo, Texas, because it could affect more than just mifepristone and drugs related to reproductive health. It could be virtually any drug that is petitioned to be removed from the U.S. marketplace.
So, Michelle Goodwin, talk about Samuel Alito and his role. I mean, this came under his jurisdiction, but Justice Alito is well known as the man who is the author of the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade. So what it means that he was the original person who extended the stay and now has done it again.
Well, it's hard to read the tea leaves with that, but you make an excellent point, which is that Justice Alito authored the decision in Dobbs, that June 24th, 2022 decision just less than a year ago that overturned Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Planned Parenthood v. Casey was a 1992 decision and Roe v. Wade 1973, so we're talking about decades of precedent, then rendered virtually meaningless through the Dobbs decision. You know, it's worth noting that the Dobbs decision was a case that came out of the state of Mississippi where there had only been one abortion clinic, and in that state, if you're a black woman, you're 118 times more likely to die by carrying a pregnancy to term than by having an abortion. But Justice Alito's opinions in this domain must also be linked to the Burwell v. Hobby Lobby decision, which is one that challenged the mandate through the Affordable Care Act that contraceptives would be available. And Justice Alito authored that decision too, which basically meant that employers who claim some religious objection to contraception could deny that to their female employees. So we see a trajectory of cases with Justice Alito that side against reproductive health rights and justice, but we don't know exactly what the court will do in this particular case, particularly given that drug manufacturers have spoken out. And one last point is that in the Dobbs decision, the court said that these matters would be returned to the states, that the laboratories of democracy are in the states, and that if people want access to abortion, then that's the place in which these issue should be settled. By Judge Kaczmarek's order, that basically flies in the face of the Dobbs decision, meaning that if his order were allowed to stand in states like California, Illinois, New York, mifepristone would no longer be available for this use, therefore making hash of what the Supreme Court issued just last year.
Michelle Goodwin, what do you think of Congress members like AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, saying that the Biden administration should simply ignore this ruling? What are the grounds for this?
Well, you know, right now, she's not alone. There are also doctors that are articulating just how distressing this happens to be. So if we set the ground a bit more, which I think is really important, the United States is the deadliest place in all of the industrialized world to be pregnant. It's alarming, and I know for many Americans that is shocking, but we rank somewhere around 55th in the world in terms of maternal safety. That is, it's far safer to be pregnant and to have a child with dignity in countries that have been recently war-torn. In the United States, the Supreme Court conceded in 2016 in a case, Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt, that a woman is 14 times more likely in the United States to die by carrying a pregnancy to term than by having an abortion. So what does this then mean for doctors, not just AOC, for doctors in states across the country now that have banned abortion, they face, such as in Texas, 99 years incarceration, $100,000 in fines, losing their medical license to practice if, in fact, they are found to have tried to save a woman's life at a point before she was very, very close to death. And this is relating to a lawsuit that is right now in the state of Texas brought by five women who were not necessarily pro-choice. In fact, some articulated anti-abortion views, but it turned out that they would need abortions to save their lives. And in times that were most critical, with sepsis setting in, with one woman gestating twins, but one of the twins dying, and that causing health effects for her and also the other fetus, in those instances, doctors in Texas felt that they were handcuffed, that they could not respond to the urgent needs of their patients. And so what we hear from doctors, what we hear from AOC is that something must be done now. This is a time that is much like Jim Crow. It is a new Jane Crow in the United States where there are free states and there are those where people no longer have access to bodily autonomy.
You have now the leading pharmaceutical companies in this country signing a letter talking about the danger to not just mifepristone, but to all drugs. And the idea that a judge is overruling scientists at the FDA, Michelle, Professor Goodwin.
Yes. Well, that is a very deep concern and worry. Let's be clear, we're still in a pandemic, but note that over the last 3 years now, there have been people who have denied that there is such a thing as COVID, that there is a pandemic. There are people who have been pressing that COVID vaccines be taken out of the marketplace. There are people who have moral opposition to vaccines. There are parents who do not want to vaccinate their children against smallpox. You can imagine that those types of individuals could also then petition a judge that they select, that they know might have similar views, and petition that judge in order for those types of drugs to be removed from the marketplace as well. Now, years ago, that might have seemed to be something extreme and that would never happen in the United States, but we're in a critically unusual time where a case such as this has now reached the Supreme Court. And what that does mean is the potential for other kinds of petitioners to come forward who are against other prescription medications. And in some ways, when you look at the Burwell v. Hobby Lobby decision, there is an aspect of that that has already been visited by the Supreme Court.
I want to bring Julie Burkhart into this conversation. She is president of Wellspring Health Access and co-owner of Hope Clinic. She worked with Dr. George Tiller, as I said earlier, who was assassinated in church, well-known abortion provider in Wichita. Julie, just respond, if you could start off by talking about the state of abortion access in this country and your concerns about what the Supreme Court will rule and how it affects your practice and pregnant people all over the country.
Yes, thank you, and good morning. Well, we have seen with my work in both Illinois and in the state of Wyoming, which are two very different states, one where we have legal protections in Illinois and in Wyoming, where we have been in litigation and battling the state so that people can maintain their bodily autonomy. We see primarily in Illinois, we've had an uptick. We're seeing over 800 patients monthly now. Our patient volume continues to increase, has been increasing after the fall of Roe in June of 22. We see primarily our patients coming from states that have now banned abortion care. So Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, any of the states that you see surrounding that sea of blue, which is now Illinois. We also see that 50% to more than 50% of our patients, which is in line with the national numbers that we see for medication abortion. Those patients who are coming to us are requesting to terminate a pregnancy via mifepristone and misoprostol.
Can you talk about the clinics that you run? Can you talk about what happened in Wyoming and where you are in Wichita, where George Tiller died?
Yes. I will start off with Wyoming. We were set to open our doors in June, actually June 14th of 22, just 10 days before the court ruled. However, in late May of last year, we had an anti-choice arsonist set our clinic on fire. And so we have spent these past months rebuilding the clinic, and we are hopeful that we'll be able to open our doors next week. It's been quite a trek. We have, law enforcement has apprehended the arsonist just a few weeks ago. Unfortunately, you know, it was a 22-year-old Casper, Wyoming woman, Lorna Green, who decided that abortion was disturbing to her, she stated in an affidavit, and decided to set our clinic ablaze. But we did not want to let that deter us. People in every part of this country deserve to have access to reproductive health care and to make their own decisions and determinations about their bodies. And so we decided that we would dig our heels in even further in Wyoming and make sure that people have access to abortion care.
I mean, my God, Julie Burkhart, you're a certified nurse practitioner. Your Wyoming clinic was bombed, was set fire to. The clinic in Wichita, well, George Tiller, the man you worked with for years, was murdered. What, explain your bravery, why you continue. This is extremely real to you, not to mention what happens to women who are under extreme duress and or pregnant people who say they need to have an abortion.
Well, sometimes I just don't know how to answer that question. I just have a very deep conviction and feel that if we are living in the United States, people deserve everywhere, and no matter who you are, deserve access to quality health care, amongst other things. And people must be able to make their own decisions about their own bodies. So it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, living in New York or California or Wyoming or Oklahoma or Kentucky, people everywhere must have the ability to make decisions about their own lives. Otherwise, I don't feel that what we stand for in the United States then really exemplifies that intent of having true freedom for everyone in this country.
Let me ask you something. The woman who was charged in Wyoming to set fire to your clinic, she wasn't charged with domestic terrorism?
Well, she is being, and the case is still in process. There is supposed to be a grand jury hearing, I've been told, next month. I have not heard back yet from prosecutors. She is going to be charged under FACE, and I'm not sure what the other charges are at this time. I do know that the penalty carries 5 to 25 years, I believe, in prison.
Also, mifepristone is part of a two-drug regimen. The second is misoprostol. Now, if mifepristone, if people can't get it, they can use the second drug. It's not quite as effective, and it has more side effects. Is that right? So people who are pregnant will be endangered by simply having the second drug, though if you can talk about that, what this ruling means.
Well, and this is where it's been such a, you know, we have just been in limbo. It's been a ping pong effect. You know, regimens regarding medication abortion were changed after Roe fell back in June because of people coming from banned states over to legal states and not wanting to put patients or physicians in a precarious situation going back to a banned state. So here we are in a different situation with medication abortion, where we're looking at potentially providing a misoprostol-only regimen for our patients. And it's concerning because we want to continue to ensure that patients, if they need abortion care and they're coming from banned states, if they can get to a clinic in a state where it's legal, that they are not going to go back to their home state and being prosecuted by overzealous you know, attorneys in those states. So we have protocols in place that we will use if we need to, but it is definitely going to put a burden and a hardship on those patients. And we suspect that more people might opt for procedural abortions than medication abortions at that point, but we will see. And, you know, this also makes it harder, especially for people who are getting medication abortion in the mail, who are in states where it is illegal or going back to a state where it's illegal. This makes it that much harder on those people who need access to good quality health care.
I want to end with Michelle Goodwin. You now have a situation, even without this ruling, where abortion is illegal basically in something like, well, more than a dozen states and 13 states following the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade last year. Georgia also bans abortion at about 6 weeks of pregnancy before many know that they're pregnant. Florida now the same. We are talking about situations where even in the case of rape and incest, if you can talk about what this means for people across this country and take it back to Kaczmarek's decision, a well-known anti-abortion activist before he became a federal judge under Trump in Texas. And now turns out that he erased his name from a journal piece he had written against abortion when he was being considered by the Senate. And the language he used in his decision both talked about unborn humans, and this is being repeated in further decisions, and referred to the Comstock Act. If you can summarize for us where this country is headed in a legal direction, and then when this is considered in referenda across the country, when people at the grassroots have a choice to decide the direction they go in.
Well, it's a dangerous decision. There's so much that we could talk about with this, in that if you think about Roe v. Wade, a 7-2 opinion, five of those seven justices were Republican appointed. Justice Blackmun, who wrote the opinion in Roe, was put on the court by Richard Nixon. Prescott Bush, the father of George H.W. Bush, was the treasurer of Planned Parenthood. This gives you some sense of just the wide gap and distance between where we began and where we are now. In Roe v. Wade, to your point of, with regard to language, in Roe v. Wade, the court said that there is a potential life during a pregnancy. And that's right, because not all pregnancies will end in birth. About 15 to 20% will end in miscarriage or stillbirth. And the language now that we see coming out of the Kaczmarek ruling, using that language of unborn human child, and then writing in footnotes the preference for using this, that this is the accurate terminology to be used in such cases, really stretches medicine and science, because it's just simply not accurate to consistently what had been in American law, and also gives the perception that all pregnancies necessarily end in birth, which they simply do not. That also has ramifications then when we think about civil punishments and criminal punishments as well. We right now have in South Carolina lawmakers that are pushing forward a bill that would call for the death penalty against women who have abortions and people with the capacity for pregnancy who have abortions. There is this false sense that all pregnancies will necessarily end in a birth, and if that is interrupted in any way, then the state can criminally punish and also impose civil fines. But when you mention that there are more than a dozen states that are now in this position, if we took a map and we looked at the map of the Confederacy, of American slavery, of Jim Crow, you would find that it fits quite well over the map that is now anti-abortion. And there's something to be said about those states that were never beacons of freedom for women or people of color or black people particularly. And they are not beacons of hope of freedom now for black women and for people with the capacity for pregnancy in those states. And we've paid far too little attention in drawing that line. And if we draw that line from history into the present, then there are certain things that we do know. And that is, save for federal interventions, either through the Supreme Court, Congress, or executive order, these are places that have never tried to be accountable and to create remedy for the past horrors that were inflicted during slavery and during Jim Crow. To bring it all back to Dobbs, that decision that shows great solicitude to the state of Mississippi. The state of Mississippi claimed that it needed this abortion ban in order to protect the health and safety of women. Nothing could be really further than the truth, but if we think about this, it wasn't until 2013 that the state of Mississippi ratified the 13th Amendment, Amy. The 13th Amendment was that amendment which abolished slavery and involuntary servitude, one that was ratified in 1865, but it took until 2013 for Mississippi to get there. Mississippi is still working, and many of these other states, on that long arc to freedom. They're not quite there, and certainly the backdrop of where they are with regard to abortion bans shows how far away they are from recognizing the human dignity and the personhood of people with the capacity for pregnancy in their states.
Well, Michelle Goodwin, we want to thank you for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to cover this issue. The stay has been put in place until Friday, until tomorrow. Michelle Goodwin is visiting professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. And thank you to Julie Burkhart in Wichita, Kansas, president of Wellspring Health Access, co-owner of Hope Clinic. She worked with Dr. George Tiller for years.